From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Joe Biden is now the official Democratic nominee for president. And while the nation's domestic challenges are top priorities, Biden seeks to lead this country in a changed world. And if he wins, he'll have to contend with America's changed place in that world. Biden comes with some of the deepest foreign policy experience of any Democratic presidential nominee in a generation. 30 years on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a globetrotting vice president in the Obama administration. A long record that's at once a strength and a liability on the world stage. So is there a Biden doctrine? Should he become president, what would Biden have to accomplish abroad in order to meet his domestic goals? So this hour on Point, we're going to talk about America, the world, and Joe Biden. And joining us to help us do that is Stephen Walt. He's professor of international affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's also author of the book, The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. Stephen Walt, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. It's nice to be with you again.
It's great to have you. So first of all, last night we actually saw what I think was the most forthright discussion about national security, at least, and some foreign policy in the Democratic National Convention, right? Because we had Colin Powell giving a speech that we hadn't heard about before. John Kerry, of course, Chuck Hagel, Brett McGurk. There was that long montage where we heard the late John McCain. I mean, what do you make of the fact that so many of the national security and foreign policy elite or establishment stepped forward last night?
Well, that's in a sense not surprising. I mean, the foreign policy establishment has been opposed to Donald Trump since 2016, when you'll remember that both Democrats, but also over 100 Republican foreign policy officials, you know, signed open letters criticizing Trump as a candidate way back then. And I don't think there's been much of a reconciliation in the intervening 4 years. I think what the Democrats are now doing is trying to point out to people that, you know, however upset you might be about unemployment and about COVID-19, you shouldn't forget that this has, for the most part, been a pretty unsuccessful administration in terms of foreign policy, and bringing some Republicans out to remind people of that is an effective political ploy.
Mm. But of course, Stephen, I mean, you've written a whole book about how it's that same foreign policy elite that you said you write has failed America. Yeah. So why should anyone listen to what they said last night?
One should be at least somewhat skeptical about some of the things they might want to do. And I think the biggest challenge for a Biden administration is going to be sort of controlling its desire to try and wind the clock back to 2016, to some nostalgic era where they see the United States as leading a benevolent world order, where lots of countries around the world were very deferential to the United States, and where, again, in this sort of nostalgic reading, everything was just going our way. I think the world has moved on in a variety of ways, partly for reasons connected to Donald Trump, partly for reasons just have to do with developments going on around the world. And I think the Biden team understands they can't turn the clock back, but they would like to. And managing that tension, sort of figuring out what they need to do differently. And I might add, learning from the mistakes that were made really beginning in the early 1990s. But especially after 2000, and so that we don't repeat those under a Biden administration, that's going to be, I think, the overarching strategic challenge for the new team, if in fact they get a chance in office.
Okay, so I want to actually play then a moment from what former Secretary of State John Kerry said last night. And here he is talking about actually our current president.
Before Donald Trump, we used to talk about American exceptionalism. The only thing exceptional about the incoherent Trump foreign policy is that it has made our nation more isolated than ever before. Joe Biden knows we aren't exceptional because we bluster that we are. We are exceptional because we do exceptional things.
John Kerry last night at the Democratic National Convention. Stephen Walt, respond to that, because you basically just said that this is the exact kind of thinking that we cannot, that if Biden wins, he cannot succumb to the nostalgia around that, around American exceptionalism on the global stage. And yet we heard it last night. We heard it a lot.
Right. And again, the problem they're facing is that Donald Trump did, in fact, have reasonably good instincts on a number of key issues. I think he implemented those instincts quite badly, which is why his foreign policy hasn't succeeded. But, you know, he understood that China was an increasing challenge and that our economic relationship with China needed to be changed, a position that I think the Biden team now also agrees with. He understood that our NATO allies were not pulling their weight in terms of common security affairs. Again, I don't think he's handled that relationship particularly well. He was very critical of the so-called forever wars like Iraq and Afghanistan back in 2016. It's worth noting, by the way, that Biden was also somewhat critical of the way in which we were prosecuting the war in Afghanistan when he was in the Obama administration. And just one final thing, you know, Trump understood eventually, not initially, but eventually understood that there was no military option for dealing with something like a problem like North Korea and its nuclear arsenal, that you had to use diplomacy. Now, in all of those areas, I think Trump pursued those instincts in rather inept and inconsistent fashions. But those instincts were basically right, and they're somewhat at odds with what I think has been the thrust of American foreign policy for a long time. So I think the new Biden administration, you know, will come in, they will embrace the idea of multilateral cooperation with all of our traditional allies. But that's not going to be as easy as it might have been in earlier periods. You know, for example, Biden has proposed convening what he called a global summit of democracies. But that raises all sorts of interesting problems. You know, what do you do with countries like Poland and Hungary and Turkey that have been moving in illiberal or undemocratic directions, yet are still formal allies within NATO? What do you do with the non-democracies that we have close relationships with, like Saudi Arabia or Egypt? And finally, even if you want to emphasize that we're going to cooperate with all of our traditional democratic allies, something that sounds very good to most Americans, you still have to try to do business on a variety of issues with countries like North Korea or China or Russia, or even if you're competing with them rather actively. So again, the fear is that Biden will fall back on a lot of familiar phrases and familiar tropes, try to rebuild this old world that you know, once existed, but it's going to be a much more difficult task for him than you might think. And it's in part because he's going to have to overcome some of the damage that Trump and his approach to foreign policy has inflicted over the past 4 years or so.
And, I mean, we're talking about a world that has been changed by this pandemic as well. I mean, it's just, I think it's completely changed the chessboard here a lot, which it was already set up for that, but the pandemic, I think, accelerated it. I do want to note, tell listeners that, by the way, we did reach out to the Biden campaign and the DNC as well and we requested that one of the now Democratic nominees, foreign policy advisors, if they could join us, and both the campaign and the DNC declined. So just wanted to put that out there. But Stephen, take a step back with me a little bit, because you heard me start the show by saying that Biden has actually all this deep, decades-long foreign policy experience, both as a member and chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He was very active on foreign policy in the Obama administration as vice president. And yet at the same time, as I was reacquainting myself with his foreign policy career, I couldn't necessarily discern if there was a or is a Biden doctrine of any kind. I mean, could you describe what Biden's approach to foreign policy is?
I think Biden has enormous knowledge and background experience, as you just traced. But no, he's not a conceptualizer. He has been, I think, pretty firmly within the mainstream of American foreign policy, which for many years was fairly bipartisan, as I'm sure Trump will point out during the campaign, you know, Biden supported the Iraq War in 2003, as did, you know, all Republicans and most Democrats as well. So in that sense, he's never deviated very far from the mainstream consensus. But what's interesting now, as you've already indicated, is we are facing a very different world. I mean, COVID is an obvious example. We're still facing a global pandemic, and one in which, for the most part, countries have tried to solve it on their own. It's been every country for itself. There hasn't been an enormous amount of global cooperation to try and address this. And I actually don't think that's likely to change much in a Biden administration. There may be more lip service to it, but mostly the responses will be here at home. And I certainly hope they're more effective than what we've had up until now. The other thing that Biden has to wrestle with is, in some respects, the Democratic Party is changing, as is the Republican Party on this. The progressive wing in the Democratic Party has very different attitudes on a number of these questions, and I see a number of foreign policy questions, and I think you see some signs of that having an impact on Biden. For example, his views on international trade have moved from where they were, I think, earlier in his career, were very much a believer in open trade, free trade, things like that, major trade deals of various sorts. And he has moved in what you'd call more of the Bernie Sanders direction on that, recognizing that the international trading order was not doing a sufficient job of the protecting interests of workers, and that some of the arrangements that we've had in place for 25 years or more needed to be changed, moving in some respects closer to the view that both Sanders and even Trump have expressed on trade. And you can multiply that across a number of other issues that the his advisors, I think, are for the most part drawn from the old guard of the Democratic Party, but younger generations, some of the politicians coming up, some of the people who were advising candidates like Sanders and even Elizabeth Warren are going to have more of a voice in where that, I think, where the administration goes, and will certainly be putting pressure on the administration on a variety of issues.
Well, we are talking this hour about foreign policy and Joe Biden and America's changed place in the world. We'll have a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're talking about foreign policy and what that might look like in a Biden administration if Joe Biden wins the November election. And I know you're thinking, foreign policy? Why? Why are we talking about that? Because really, we have some very pressing domestic issues, like the economy, like the pandemic. And agreed, totally agreed. But my big question here is, any president, and Joe Biden, if he wins in November, what might that person need to accomplish abroad in order to meet those goals of rebuilding America internally? That's kind of the thing I really want to explore this hour. And Stephen Walt is a professor of international affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and author of The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. And he's joining us to help think through these questions. Now, Stephen, I want to explore a little bit more about what Biden's history as a longtime senator on the Foreign Relations Committee, for example, and his foreign policy experience, what that might tell us, because people have quite strong opinions of Biden on this. And I want to play a moment from a 2014 interview that Steve Inskeep of Morning Edition did with former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, because as you know, in 2014, Gates wrote a book called Duty, Memoirs of a Secretary at War. And Gates said of Joe Biden, I think he's been wrong on nearly every major foreign policy and national security over the past four decades. And again, Steve Inskeep on Morning Edition asked Gates to elaborate, and here's what he said.
The vice president, when he was a senator, a very new senator, voted against the aid package for South Vietnam that was part of the deal when we pulled out of South Vietnam to try and help them survive. He said that when the Shah fell in Iran in 1979, that was a step forward for or progress toward human rights in Iran. He opposed virtually every element of President Reagan's defense buildup. He voted against the B-1, the B-2, the MX. He voted against the first Gulf War. So on a number of these major issues, I frankly, over a long period of time, I think he'd been wrong.
That's former Defense Secretary Robert Gates on NPR in 2014. Stephen Walt, respond to that. What do you think?
that's not a great track record. One could, in fact, elaborate a little bit more on it. I think if I were defending Biden, I would say there are a bunch of issues where he's been correct. For example, back in 2009, when Barack Obama was contemplating whether to do a surge in Afghanistan, Biden was the main voice within the administration who suggested that, you know, a light footprint, counterterrorism focus, not trying to do an ambitious surge or ambitious nation building approach in Afghanistan made much more sense. And I think the next decade has shown that his prescription was, in fact, the correct one there. So, you know, I think everybody's track record, if you're in politics for a long time, is likely to have some embarrassing mistakes in it. One could also debate some of those, whether or not, you know, Reagan's defense buildup was actually unnecessary and wasteful, whether or not the aid package for South Vietnam early in his career was a good idea or not, you know, given that we had already lost that war. So even Gates's indictment, it seems to me, is not unassailable as well. But I don't think that's actually the real question. The real question we ought to be asking is this someone who is likely to assemble a team and be able to adapt American foreign policy to the conditions that we find ourselves in now? I think that's very important, in part because, first of all, you know, the Trump team has been thin all along, with lots of positions unfilled, with foreign policy handled by a sort of revolving door of advisors who don't stick around very long. And he's now at his third national security advisor, his third secretary of defense, et cetera. And I think one thing the Biden team will do is they will come in and they will try to restore the capacity of our foreign policy machinery. That's not going to be something you can do overnight, but I think they understand that you can't have an energetic or active foreign policy without really smart and talented people implementing it as well. I worry a little bit that they will have too long a to-do list. But when you talked about the importance of the domestic agenda, my guess is in the first year of a Biden administration, they would like foreign policy to be as quiet as possible so that they can focus very heavily on what needs to be done here at home. The challenge, of
I was just going to say, except that I think there's major aspects of foreign policy that have a direct impact on domestic policy. I mean, trade being the one that pops up into my
We're not going to get a new trade deal in the first year of any administration. You know, they may talk about trying to rejoin TPP, which, you know, went forward without us, but they won't do it under the format of the original TPP for a variety of reasons. And that will take some time to negotiate. You know, you'll see things like that, but I don't think he wants to be distracted by, you know, big, ambitious international agenda. And in particular, you know, I don't think Joe Biden is going to be traveling overseas any more than Donald Trump did. And that means he will have to rely upon his Secretary of State, on the assistant secretaries, on ambassadors, on his other advisors to do some of the reassuring of allies, some of the new initiatives as well. And you sort of save the president for those moments when you finally have to clinch a new arrangement or clinch an agreement. I think in that sense, they will use Biden rather sparingly because he's going to need to focus very much on trying to fix things here at home. The only caveat you have to ask there is, you know, sometimes you don't get to control your foreign policy agenda because something happens someplace that you feel you have to respond to. But I think in the first year, at least, they would be well advised to have, you know, a relatively unambitious foreign policy agenda and to focus most of their attention here at home.
So, Stephen Walt, real talk. I think both you and I have been in that public radio way, stepping lightly around some concrete realities, which I just think we got to hit head on. Okay, so like, sure. Regardless of whoever wins in November, you and I have both used the language of a changed world. It's profoundly changed. Let's be honest. I'm looking at something that you recently wrote, where you talked about how for a century, U.S. influence on the world stage, U.S. primacy even, was based on, these are your pillars, right? First of all, obviously, economic and military strength. And militarily, that strength is still there. Economically, maybe a little more uncertain now, but in terms of the size of the economy, still there. Second pillar, support from an array of allies. Well, clearly, that is changing dramatically. And the third pillar that you write about, broad confidence in U.S. competence. And to be honest, that confidence internationally has been completely imploded by our own domestic handling of this pandemic. So whatever leverage, soft power leverage, the United States had, isn't that basically gone now on the world stage? I mean, like, who's going to look to U.S. leadership, even if Biden wanted to lead globally or use U.S. influence globally? Who's going to look to the U.S. for that?
You make a very good point, and given that I wrote something very similar, I'm not going to disagree with you. I think
I'm taking that straight from you. That's from your writing, Stephen.
I understand. I've written about this before, that the aura of competence, the sense around the world that Americans know what they're doing and can deliver as promised, is very important, and we've certainly squandered some of that in recent years. Not, by the way, beginning with the pandemic. I think this was happening for a while. I do think that this is something that the Biden team will go to great lengths to try and reassert that, you know, okay, we've had this unfortunate episode of the past 4 years, an incompetent team, but we're back and we know what we're doing, and they will try to demonstrate that as quickly as possible. If I wanted to be optimistic about this, I'd point out something else. Back in 2007, 2008, right, the rest of the world had a similar image of the Bush administration, not as bad, but a similar image. They had screwed up Iraq. They had screwed up Afghanistan, and they were now presiding over a major financial crisis, which they weren't handling particularly well. And you had some of the same problems, plus the fact the Bush administration was unpopular for being so unilateralist. Well, lo and behold, what happens? In 2008, we elect Barack Obama. And if you look at global opinion, the image of the United States soars immediately, even before Obama has actually done anything. Right, you'll recall he gets the Nobel Peace Prize in his first year as president, having accomplished essentially nothing at that point. What I'm suggesting is that it's possible for our image around the world, if you want to call it our soft power, to get resurrected relatively quickly. But here's, I think, the thing that's really a problem for us looking ahead. The question is how predictable the United States is. I mean, other states, you know, are more likely to cooperate with us if they're reasonably confident that we will deliver what we're promising to do. And I think that's clearly been tarnished under President Trump. The problem is that even if Trump is defeated in November, some of the impulses that drove Trumpism and certainly the deep polarization in our country is going to continue as well. And there are going to be people in the Republican Party with presidential ambitions, people like Mike Pompeo, like Tom Cotton, and others who are going to be defending many of the things that the Trump administration tried to do. What that means is that countries around the world may look at a Biden administration and they may be eager to cooperate more extensively with the Biden administration, but they're going to be asking themselves, you know, could this happen again, right? We sign a new set of arrangements on climate. Iran and the United States reach a new and better nuclear deal under Biden. And then everyone wonders, yeah, but maybe Biden doesn't win in 2024, or a Democrat doesn't win in 2024, and the pendulum will simply swing all the way back the other way. we better hedge. We better not count on the United States being able to deliver on something for more than one term at a time. And that leads other countries to then start looking for other arrangements that are not as dependent on cooperating with the United States. And that's, okay, again, so that's not just a Trump versus Biden thing. That's a more structural problem with the nature of our political system right now.
Totally agreed. I mean, the profound at each other's throats partisanship is something that the entire world is seeing, and it has led people to believe that or wonder if the United States is a trustworthy, consistent partner. I mean, absolutely. So on that point, Stephen, let me just bring in another voice into this conversation. Leslie Vinjamuri joins us from London. She's Dean of the Queen Elizabeth II Academy for Leadership in International Affairs and Director of the U.S. and the Americas Program at Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs. Leslie Vinjamuri, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. Great to be on the show.
So respond to what Stephen Walt just said about has the international community's, and granted there are different viewpoints here, but has the international community's view of the United States as a consistent partner changed?
Well, undoubtedly, in the current period, the dominant perception, and of course it varies across countries, it varies across constituencies within countries, but I think that there's a pretty strong consensus that, you know, this United States has not been consistent in its foreign policy. It's been unpredictable. It's created all sorts of trouble for the rest of the world. But I think, you know, the key difference, to go to Steve Walt's comments between 2007-08, and it is absolutely true that global public opinion, certainly public attitudes towards the United States across Europe, were remarkably low at the end of the Bush administration. They rebounded. But I think the key difference in the current period is that it's not only America's foreign policy. It's that the rest of the world, and especially here in Europe, people look back to the United States, and there's a level of shock about the dysfunction that seems to be permeating all of the United States. Remember that when people are watching the United States here in London or across the continent, they're watching it through the lens of the media. So they don't see everyday life where things are still going on and some of them are good. Most of what people see are the very dramatic headlines, 170,000 Americans dying, more dying every day, infection rates going on, people are walking through corridors of crowded high schools without masks, the president saying that it doesn't matter. This is what they see. And the confidence in the United States isn't just, will we have a president that recommits to global trade, to the Iran deal, to the climate accords, that thinks more seriously about immigration, about global health. It's, can America restore itself? Will its economy come back? There's probably more confidence in that. But will the country come back? Will it unify? And will it function? I think that's where we're in a just fundamentally different period in terms of global public opinion and public attitudes.
So those same questions are vitally important for Americans themselves to answer.
Of course.
But I'm already getting a lot of feedback on social media about people wondering, why should they even care what the global community thinks, right? Eric Turner says, we don't elect the leader of the world. Our constitution doesn't authorize world leadership. Our government exists for one purpose, to serve this country and the people of this country. So what would you say to Americans who are like, well, it doesn't matter what Europe thinks or what Asia thinks or what China thinks about the integrity of the United States?
Well, I think that, you know, the old line, right? Joe Nye, soft power. America is the place that people want to go. They want to spend their money. They want to spend their time. They want to send their children to college. And they want to replicate the model in all of its wonderful forms across their own societies. So I think that there's a level of modeling, of role modeling. There's a form of power and influence that just simply doesn't exist in the same way anymore. It's quite shocking. Personally, I think a lot of it will come back in time, but that's certainly not the perception that people have right now. If you look at global attitudes, even in January, right before the pandemic, 64% of people polled across 32 countries didn't have any confidence in the president to do the right thing. there is a difference, right, between public attitudes and expert communities and leaders. I think expert communities, whether you're talking about scientists, environmental scientists, economists, any number of industry specialists who are still deeply embedded in their networks, working with their partners across the United States, they know the rigor and the expertise that exists in the United States, and they're working with it. But in the early days of the pandemic, there was a sense that that was enough, right? That states and governors and university heads and mayors could keep America going in the face of a dysfunctional center. And now I think people beyond America's borders just don't hold that same view anymore.
Well, we are talking this hour about Joe Biden's foreign policy experience and if he wins in November, how that might play out as president. And also we're talking about fundamentally America's changed place on the world stage. So we have a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking today about Joe Biden's decades-long foreign policy experience and if he wins the general election in November, how that might play out in a Biden presidency. I'm joined today by Stephen Walt. He's professor of international affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and author of The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. Leslie Vinjamuri also joins us as well. She's director of the U.S. and the Americas program at Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs. And I also want to remind listeners that we did reach out to the Biden campaign and the DNC as well and requested interviews with foreign policy advisors to Joe Biden right now, and both groups declined our invitation. Now, Stephen, I want to circle back to something you said earlier, and Leslie, I want to hear your response to this as well. And it has to do with the what might be a liability of Joe Biden's deep policy experience, because you talked about how there might be this pull to ways of thinking that are pre-COVID or even, you know, the early 21st century. Now, in order to set that up, let me just play a couple of clips here. This, first of all, is what Joe Biden said at Davos at the World Economic Forum in January of 2017. So literally just 48 hours before he ended his second term as vice president of the United States. And he talked a lot about allies and alliances, international alliances. And he said that the United States and NATO allies, all the nations of Europe, are stronger together. They're the oldest and strongest democracies in the world. They have a responsibility to beat back challenges at their doors. And then he went on to say this.
We must never forget how far we've come, how we got here, or take for granted that this success will continue without an awful lot of really hard work and investment. It's only by championing the liberal international order, by continuing to invest in our security, reaffirming our shared values, expanding the cause of liberty around the world, that we are going to retain our position of leadership. Because if we don't fight for our values, no one else will.
That's Joe Biden in 2017 at Davos. Now, Biden gave a foreign policy speech in July, just last month, at the City University of New York, and he talked about NATO again.
This president has bankrupted America's word in the world at the moment. He's alienated us from the very democratic allies we need most. Trump has taken a battering ram to the NATO alliance. He treats us like it's some kind of American-run protection racket. He just doesn't get it. I really don't think he gets it. NATO is at its heart, the very heart of NATO and our national security. More than that, it is an alliance of values.
Joe Biden in July. Stephen, well, you've got a pretty different view of NATO now. So is this one of your an example that you might point to of sort of the pull to old ways of thinking?
Yeah, I think it's a good illustration of it. First of all, NATO is always, we always talk about how it's an alliance of shared values and shared democracy, but that's never actually been entirely true. It was primarily a defensive alliance against the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, and that was its main raison d'etre, and it's, in a sense, been trying to reinvent itself ever since the Cold War ended. And it's worth noting that there are a whole set of NATO members whose commitment to democracy today is much weaker than you might like. Poland, Hungary, Turkey being the obvious examples there. So to put all the emphasis on NATO's shared values, I think understates the frictions and the tensions within that. I think also we're going to see in a Biden administration or in a second Trump administration, if that's where we end up, an increasing problem of trying to figure out where Europe and where our NATO allies are vis-a-vis the emerging rivalry between the United States and China, which is going to, mm-hmm. I think, dominate the geopolitics of the next decade or more. And Europe has not been clear where it wanted to line up in that regard. And different European countries have different views about that. And I think, basically, if Europe wants to sort of remain neutral in the contest between the United States and China, and yet at the same time continue to count on American military protection in at least certain circumstances, that's simply not going to be tenable. That a Biden administration or a Trump administration is going to put a great deal of pressure on NATO to essentially line up on our side. We've seen this in the contest over whether or not NATO countries or European countries will use Huawei 5G technology, for example. Mm-hmm. And I think that problem is going to continue. So, yes, I think a Biden administration will try to revitalize NATO, will certainly dispense with the gratuitous insults that the Trump administration has used to no good purpose vis-a-vis NATO. But there's going to be some serious bargaining that's going to have to be struck. And if the United States is focusing more attention on Asia, I think it is inevitable that it will expect its European allies to line up with it vis-a-vis China and also to do more to manage security problems within Europe itself. I think that's the long-term direction. Yeah. And that'll be true, I think, in a maybe a more amicable and diplomatic way under Biden. But in some respects, that trend will happen in a bumpier and more disruptive way if Trump happens to be reelected.
But Leslie, let me just turn back to you on this, because even if there is more amicable diplomacy under perhaps a Biden administration, to Stephen's point, I'm not sure it really matters, because the fundamental truth is Europe, various European nations haven't had to be clear about what their views are regarding China versus the United States, and that is really quite different than it's been before. I mean, it's not. You don't have to be all that old to remember a different kind of global reality where there was no question who Europe would stand by.
Well, I mean, I think there are a couple of things here. There's a very serious conversation going on within the European Union, across all of the capitals in Europe, certainly in the UK, about what their position is on China. It's moving much closer to the United States, not only because of U.S. pressure, but also because of changes in China. But I think, you know, this broader point, this fear that the United States under a Biden administration would take the world back to the liberal international order, let's be clear what that means. Taking the United States back to working with Europeans on climate change, taking the United States back to working with the Europeans and the rest of the world on pandemic prevention, thinking about managing the Iran threat in a more predictable and serious way, talking about putting free trade and fair trade rules back on the agenda in a way that's consistent and inclusive. It's really hard to argue against any of those goals. Where America was, where it was moving, was actually not so bad in terms of NATO. You know, NATO's been, Steve Wald is absolutely right, trying to find its purpose. But if you go back to the most recent meeting that they had in London, the first time when they really began to talk seriously about China, and using NATO as a forum for talking about China's role in Europe and its implications for security in the transatlantic space, certainly a very useful forum for doing that. It's not clear why you have to, and I'm not suggesting that this is certainly not Steve's, what Steve said, but why you have to abandon the format, but using it to generate further cooperation, I think would be a good thing, certainly after the 4 years that Europe's had to endure under the current administration.
Actually, Leslie said quite a bit there, Stephen, but let me just, let's have you respond to a couple of bits of it. First of all, sort of the taking the United States back to certain, to the level of certain agreements that were baked in the cake beforehand. Let me just ask you, Stephen, if Biden wins in November, would you like to see some of that as sort of day one foreign policy priorities?
Yeah, I think that's right. And with the caveat that he has to be careful that he doesn't come out with a list of 20 top foreign policy priorities. If he comes up forward with three or four, that I think is much more plausible, because there's actually some chance of delivering them. And some of them would be, from a foreign policy point of view, relatively easy for a president to pursue. I liked Leslie's list a lot, you know, climate change, returning to the Paris Accord and beginning to work to improve that. I think it's, you know, clear with each passing month that we have delayed far too long to make progress there. Trying to go back to the Iran deal or begin a process with Iran and with the other signatories of the JCPOA that would lead to a new agreement, I think that that's a possibility, much more likely to happen under a Biden administration. And that's still the best way to keep Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. So that's in our interest as well. That list is a pretty good list. But none of those things are going to be accomplished overnight, which is why they have to be careful not to sort of load up the agenda with more things than they can actually get across the finish line.
So I suppose I'm still, both of you forgive me, because I'm still just kind of struggling with some fundamentals here. I can't really get away from the fact that one of the things that President Trump keyed into, and Stephen, you were talking about this earlier, in the 2016 campaign season, was that in the United States and in other countries, there is this ongoing rejection of something that Leslie had just mentioned a few minutes ago, this idea of a liberal world order. Others would call it a liberal hegemony, right? The United States had a duty to spread democracy, markets, other liberal values far and wide. I mean, Joe Biden, that tape we just played, he used that very language. So if that's kind of like one of the basic things that has changed, how does any U.S. president, where does any U.S. president begin? Like, where's the United States place in that if the fundamental presumptions of what foreign policy ought to look like or the goals of foreign policy are different now than they were 10, 15 years ago?
Well, I'll take the first swing at that. I mean, obviously, I think if they try to return to the very ambitious goals of the Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations, that we were going to create a global order that was more or less made in America of, you know, free markets, free trade, democracy spreading. If they try to go back to that as an active agenda, it will work just as well in the future as it did in the past, which is to say not very. And it's quite clear that there are some countries are simply not interested in going that route and are strong enough and capable enough to resist it. It's not going to succeed. It may not even succeed on its own terms. If that, however, is the set of values you would like to promote, and if that's where you think the world ought to be moving at a sort of more measured pace, then what Leslie was saying earlier is exactly right. You have to get our act together here at home. We have to fix the problems in America so that other countries look at what's happening in our society and they admire it and they want something more like that. Instead of government dysfunction, instead of a bad pandemic response, instead of deep racial division, if they start to see something that looks very positive, as I think was true in earlier periods, then other countries are more likely to move towards our values, but at their own pace. And that has always struck me as a much sounder way of reconciling you know, our commitment to a certain set of political goals and values with the limits of the power that even the United States has and the inherent difficulty of reengineering other countries.
So let me just jump in here and turn to you, Leslie, because what Stephen is saying there, I can see the logic of it. You know, get your own house in order. But that's also, quite frankly, I don't see that as anything less than a project in the United States domestically of years, if not decades. And in the meantime, as we've been talking about, the global, the international community keeps changing. China keeps rising. So, I see those lines sort of diverging over time rather than coming closer together.
Well, I mean, first of all, let's be fair. It's not only the United States that needs to get its house in order. I'm sitting here in the UK, a country that's having deep crises of its own on any number of dimensions, not least, of course, the immediate one, which is the pandemic and the health and economic crisis that it's driving. So the US is not alone. There are a lot of countries, certainly a lot of America's partners and allies, that are going to be very much focused back at home. But you can't solve many of the problems at home without dealing with some of the global problems. And the pandemic has taught us that. So at the same time that the U.S. will be turning back home, I don't think that, you know, the pandemic and the health crisis is a domestic one. Coordinating the distribution of a vaccine is a global issue unless America intends to close its borders indefinitely. And at great cost to Americans and to the American economy, it's going to have to get ahead of the game and invest in a serious strategy for getting a vaccine and any number of therapeutics distributed across the country. And to do that, it's going to want to work with Europeans and many other partners. So I do think that, you know, these agendas are going to go forward simultaneously. Clearly, the trade agenda. And China simply isn't going to let it, you know, that issue isn't going to weigh. In fact, we can see that it's accelerating. I think the other key thing is that, you know, the part of the liberal order that nobody really wants back is the human rights evangelism. It's the human rights interventions. It's the going into other countries and doing regime change. But nobody is talking about that. Certainly not the Biden team. It's just not where things are headed. And I don't think it's even a legitimate critique to think that that's on the cards. Of course, there are black swan events that could change that. The fair trade agenda, let's be clear, you know, it's come out of the Democratic Party as much as out of Trump. It predated Trump, at least his position as president. So I don't think that's going away. And Bernie Sanders is right out in front at the Democratic National Convention. So I think that Joe Biden knows that this is a world that's going to be about clear and predictable rules, but rules that are fair for Americans. So, on that dimension also, I think that we will see an investment in the international right from the beginning.
Well, on that point, we've got to wrap up because I think it just underscores how what happens abroad or what the United States hopes to accomplish domestically, the two are truly intertwined. So Leslie Vinjamuri, director of the U.S. and America's program at Chatham House, thank you so much for joining us. And Stephen Walt, professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of The Hell of Good Intentions, thank you as well. This is On Point.